Welcome to episode 47 of Gallifrey Public Radio. With the announcement of the 12th Doctor near at hand, Jay and Keir seem almost psychic as they discuss some of the most recent mistruths from our favorite mop-top Welshman. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Whitten.
We need somebody who is more intense.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
I demand to be referred to as Sagacity from now on.
And Keir Hansen.
The jockstrap of Rassilon is formidable and large.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 47 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where the Whovian news descends from above like manna from the vortex, and though we may listen with both ecstatic joy and abject terror, sometimes both at the same time, we ultimately realize who is speaking and must remember rule number one, Steemo lies.
Lies.
I am Jay, and with me in the GPR studio tonight is Keir. How's it going, Keir?
Very good, sir. And yourself?
Fairly well.
All right. Awesome.
So this week we're actually, Melissa got called away, had some stuff come up, so she's not going to be here with us. So we're pushing our discussion of the novels back for a week. Mm-hmm. But we decided to take a look at the showrunner that we have, who apparently can't seem to give us any sort of truth whatsoever.
Yeah, you might have seen him. Funny looking dude. Bit of a northern and a Welsh accent. Got a mop of head in his hair. Looks like a Brillo pad. You know the guy.
Yeah. Speaking of hobbits.
No. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So I mean, it's come to light recently, especially at Comic-Con when he said that he's lied his arse off for about the 50th. It's, you know, we've known that Moffat has a penchant for telling us less than the whole truth sometimes, mm-hmm. and it's just kind of gotten thrown into stark contrast lately.
Yeah. I think it's good, though, that this is coming about as it is when it is, because we were kind of concerned that that the buildup to what we were going to have in November was going to sort of peak and drop off when no further news was really being developed. But as a result of this fortunately being con season, you know, it allows for opportunity for panels to really get grilled on certain things. And they may be guided to let certain things slip here or there. You know, Jenna Coleman isn't exactly, and I'm going to say this right here and now, you know, outside of her working up a script, she's not necessarily the most well-versed, well-spoken person. So she does, you know, provide some gaffes every once in a while that could let some stuff go. So people listen to what she says in press junkets very closely.
She's not the most careful speaker there is. That's
no,
for sure.
Well, she's excited about this. This is probably the biggest thing that's happened with her career, and she's riding the wave on it, and that's great. But there are probably very, very stringent gag orders around BBC, stuff that would rival, you know, Disney or Lucasfilms, they have to watch for this sort of thing. Also related to our good friend Mr. Barrowman, who is a constantly state of upheaval.
So, yeah.
You know, this gives us a chance to finally take the man himself, throw some questions at him, and see if, in his judgment, at a point where we know we're still months away from getting some really definitive stuff, you know, getting some additional teaser trailers or something like that, he can stir the pot a bit. So ask the questions and hope that he answers. And what does he do? He throws it back in your face and says, anything I say or don't say doesn't matter because I've been lying for so long.
Yeah.
And it's a jump ball.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I mean, he's, you know, it all came about because people were asking him about Captain Jack. They're like, why isn't he in there? And he's like, how do you know he's not in there? You know, I've been lying this whole time.
Yeah. You know, well, they were hitting him about that, and they were also hitting him about the appearances from all the living doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And that had been one of the earliest discussion points when we knew that this entire project was going to be put together. And they thought, wouldn't it be fantastic, you know, or even if some small means there was a tip of the hat or an appearance or a cameo in or out of character, you know, just having Tom Baker hopping on a bus in the background or something like that, where there's a representation from all the remaining doctors.
Yeah.
But, and I guess they must have really been pounding the hell out of him there in Hall H. So he decided to give it right back.
Yeah.
And legitimately so. I think if anyone's allowed to, he can. I was thinking about this earlier, and Jay, I'll bounce this off because we didn't prep anything for this as far as what we were going to really go into. an observation of mine is that take it or leave it. You know, we've sat in some panels ourselves at various cons, and we've had some discussions with Hoovy in the past, present, future,
right?
About the RTD versus Steamo eras in New Who,
yeah,
and the merits of each of them and the downfalls of each of them. And a lot of people do like to slam Moffat for a lot of things.
Plot holes.
Plot holes, exceedingly long character arcs that don't quite resolve the way they want them to, or other characters that don't get a chance to go through any sort of a progression and where they feel they're deserved. Spin-offs that people think are warranted that haven't been given the opportunity. All kinds of things. You know, they'll beat up on them a bit.
Right.
But my realization, and I'll throw this to you to see if you think it has any validity to it, is that all of the I'm not going to say hatred, but all of the mistrust and all of the grousing that people do about some of his decisions and some of his statements or his misdirections in this particular case are a testament to how he fits the show. Because the show can't be something that satisfies everyone. The show has to have an element of mystery to it and misdirection to it. So is he essentially running it the way we like to see the show behave?
I think you're right. I mean, that's as much crap as Moffat gets sometimes, he's really on top of it. He really knows what it is that drives the show, what it is that fans, you know, truly want, despite what, you know, their tumblers say, and what, you know, it's what the show is truly about, as opposed to what the fans think they want in the moment. And he really does get that.
I think he's we've always given him a lot of credit for having the deep amount of respect and adoration that he has for classic Who constructs,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to either revisit them or reinvent them, or at least just reference them, you know, somewhere along the way to kind of give the long-standing fans an opportunity to say, okay, you really are paying attention,
yeah,
you know, to 50 years of history.
Yeah, that's the thing, is everything that Moffat does, you can tell it's a mixture of I'm trying to do the best I can as showrunner, but he's still just a fanboy at heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like everything he does has that, you know, that fan in him at the core of it. He's trying to make, you know, he makes difficult decisions sometimes to keep the show going and keep it from getting stagnant, but it all comes down to the fact that he's a fan and he, you know, he puts out what he thinks would be a good thing for the show.
And you always have to bear in mind that he is not the end all be all. He answers to the BBC.
Yeah.
I mean, he is the showrunner, but he does not run the network. So, therefore, you know, if there are executive decisions that come down from positions higher than his, to a certain degree, he's got a kowtow. So, you know, maybe that has something to do with the fact that, you know, we were a little unhappy with some of the aspects of Series 7, you know, from a flow standpoint, because maybe he had gotten some sort of a directive that said, you know, you need to make some of these things more episodic, you need to jump locations. You can't get bogged down in some of these arcs. You're making things a little too mysterious. People feel like they can't watch them out of order. If they miss one, they're screwed. You know, so stir it up a bit.
Yeah.
You know? And of course, he's, you know, as a consummate professional, he's not going to say, "Well, the network made me do it." You know, he'll take ownership of it. But he seemed very satisfied with how Series 7 turned out. He was very pleased with it on the whole. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at some of the mistruths that he's given us lately. We've definitely gotten some hints along with it, but again, it's like how true are all of these things? You know, so like one thing he's, you know, he keeps saying that the search for 12 has barely begun. They don't have anyone picked for it. It's, you know, they're still kind of off, you know, trying to get to that point, but yeah. He's not ready to release the name of the 12th Doctor yet.
Sure.
And so, you know, he's not going to tell him, "Oh, no, we've got him picked. We're just not going to tell you yet." You know, so I can definitely
say that. If that were the case, if they actually did say something like, yes, we're down to the final, even if they didn't say the final choice is made, if they even said that we're down to the final stages of the decision-making process and now it's just a matter of secondary screen tests or something of that sort, it would be chum in the water.
Oh, yeah. People would go nuts.
There's been a total resurgence just within the last week or so, or that's maybe 2 weeks, oddly enough, right around con time, that all of the UK bookies are now freaking out again and totally revising their lists about who they think viable candidates are. You know, the topic of the female doctor will not go away. Not going to happen, because now every actor or actress that wants to get a quick little blurb in the press just has to come out and say, whether they're for or against it. And yeah, whether their career is soaring, or if you haven't heard of them since the late 80s, if they make a statement about, their take on the prospect of a female doctor, they're going to get an extra 15 minutes in the limelight.
Yeah, exactly.
So the whole idea of that search being in the still, as he phrases it, in the early stages, I don't know. I'd like to believe that that's true and that he's really doing his due diligence on this.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I'm assuming you had an opportunity to read over the little snippet of the sample audition page, the sides that they provide.
Yeah, it's just basically like little sample scripts that they're giving to the prospective doctors to get it's a screen test to see how they do with Clara, how they do with the lines they're given. And a lot of these sound, I'm sitting there reading over some of these and they're just blatantly Matt Smith.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm like, I was expecting to see something different, but it's like every time I'm reading it, I hear Matt Smith's voice in my head.
There's a very specific reason for that. Having worked with a lot of directors previously, what they are looking for in a lot of these instances is an individual who can take a piece of material that is recognized. Either they're, say you're doing auditions for a play that's been done for years, something like, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or something like that. And it's been produced 1,000 times, or Death of a Salesman or something like that. Right. And everybody knows these lines backwards and forwards. And it seems like in all the performances that you see, whether they're on stage or on film, they always tend to carry the same canter, the same tone, the same peaks and falls of energy levels and emotions. And you hand that to someone and give them the idea that you are now, I need you to reinvent the character.
Mm.
And in the case of the doctor, that's exactly what you're doing. You're going from something that Matt Smith has taken a couple of years to anchor. People recognize his delivery, his speech patterns, his catchphrases and so forth. But just the way that he kind of attacks a scene like this, which for those of you who hadn't had an opportunity to read it, it's like the moments after the regeneration and he's sort of checking out his features and Claire's there to sort of talk him through it. So it's a lot of this kind of back and forth, kind of tongue-in-cheek verbal volley. But you're absolutely right, Jay. It feels very Matt Smith. I think what they're trying to do is give somebody something that is inherently his conversational style or his speech style and do something different with it. Start to show how that character can evolve just as the doctor evolves.
Yeah.
So I get it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It makes sense, but it just seemed kind of strange to me. I was expecting something a little bit different, but yeah. And actually, slightly off topic, but have you heard the blurb about what Neil Gaiman talking about the 12th Doctor?
Which blurb?
Somebody asked him, who he thinks the Doctor is going to be and this, that, and the other. Just the basic leading questions that they always wind up doing. And his response to it, and I think it's great, he says, I want to see the Doctor. I want to be taken by surprise. I want to squint at a photo of a person online and go, but how can that be the Doctor? Then I want to be amazingly, delightfully, completely proven wrong. And 6 episodes in, I want to wonder how I could have been so blind, because this is the Doctor. Of course it is. I mean, that sums it up. And that's the same mentality that Stephen Moffat has. You know, he's not trying to find somebody that's going to, you know, bring fame to the show. He's not trying to find somebody that's going to fit, you know, his idea or whatever. He's trying to find the Doctor.
Right. Who could come out of, you know, the back of a produce shop in Yorkshire, for that matter. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be Hugh Laurie or, you know, or what have you. And that's absolutely respectable. And I think that coincides really well with my expectations. Yeah, part of me is going to want to know as soon as the information is known. But for me personally, if I were to be told, if there was a press release or a statement that was being made that as a result of the excessive hounding by the press and paparazzi near location and so forth, or them getting in the way of photo shoots around Cardiff or what have you, that they're putting the entire thing on lockdown, working on sound stages, and they're not going to announce the 12th Doctor until 2 weeks before the anniversary episode airs. You know, it came down to something that draconian. I'd be okay with it. I'd grumble a little bit. How dare they grumble?
Right.
But somewhere in the back of my head, as much as I'd like to know just for the sake of knowing, that element of surprise, and just as Eamon was able to very eloquently put, as he so often does, the idea of looking and saying, who? That one? Really? I don't know about this.
Yeah.
And then you invest a couple of weeks into it, and you get locked in. Now, I know some people just never jive with Smith.
Yeah.
They just didn't. And that's legit. But there are just as many people who, and these are not even new fans, who have seen the breadth and scope. Maybe it was just 9th, 10th, 11th, or maybe they got to see some Classic Who and then new, who would still honestly consider 11th to be their Doctor.
Yeah.
I respect it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. Everybody's got their Doctor, but you can't deny the fantastic casting that they've always done with this show. You know, name one Doctor who, you know, I don't want to say you didn't like, but name one Doctor who didn't fit the role. Yeah,
I'll rephrase that. Who didn't become the role.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. That's what I was trying to get. Thank you.
Yeah. We might've been a little, I mean, even you and I felt a little clunky with Smith in the 11th hour or even going back and getting an opportunity to see some of the regenerations in Classic Who that I personally had never gotten a chance to see.
Yeah.
Something like, you know, 6th into 7th and things like that. And like seeing Sylvester McCoy for the first time, thinking, who is this goofy little lop-faced, you know, oddball with the hat and the lisp? No, come on. Could you make him any weaker? I don't want somebody who's this weak. I mean, we were coming off of Colin Baker, who was like, you know, grabbed by the lapels and scream at you kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you know what? Even though, you know, he may not rank as one of the highest or most beloved Doctors, you're never going to take that away from him. For that run, you know, banging around the universe with Ace and a bazooka.
Oh, yeah.
He was the Doctor.
Yeah.
So that brings us to an interesting next point, though. One of the things that, you know, we were talking about the idea of the all of this supposition about, you know, known actor versus unknown or relatively unknown, female versus male and so forth. There's also the idea of what necessarily has to be the age demographic,
right,
for our next Doctor. You know, is it time now to sort of break away from the pretty boy cycle that they've been in since 2005?
Yeah.
And put in somebody a little grizzly. I said grizzled, maybe not grizzly.
A dead Doctor.
Yeah, and that's one thing Moffat has come out and said. He says, we've never not considered an older Doctor. It is completely on all the lists we make. There are absolutely older Doctors.
Yeah.
And I've definitely got to get behind him on this, say that, you know, I think that while he may have an idea as to who he wants on, like, the top of his list, I know he's probably got a couple older actors, even if they're not in the top like one or two.
Right.
You know, because you can't deny that, you know, England has some fantastic older actors. You know, both male and female. So what's to stop you from using one of those actors who's been around the block, who knows the role inside and out? You know, it would be stupid not to consider them.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll be discussing this in a little bit when we get to some of the news items that have been coming up around the week. But there are some new names that have been sort of thrown into the mix that could be really interesting.
Yeah.
In terms of what they could potentially bring to the table. But I think it's going back as far as the, you know, you were making the point about or sort of reiterating Gaiman's point about the recognizability or the household name nature of whoever sort of rises to the top of the list there. Male or female doesn't really matter. I honestly do not think that young or old, male or female, we are going to be looking to anyone with a truly right off the top of your head kind of dossier. You know, this is not somebody who's going to have a thick IMDb profile.
Right, yeah. And I mean, that's the thing that they've always tried to do, is aim for the not necessarily unknown actors, but definitely not tremendously famous. You know, I mean, Chris Eccleston has he's got a good career behind him. You know, I always knew him as the Carpenter in Gone in 60 Seconds, and then he was in G.I. Joe, and I'm not sure where all these fall in with when he was in Doctor Who, but, you know, he's a well-known actor, but he wasn't tremendously well-known.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's somebody that you can still look at and be like, who the heck's this guy with the, you know, northern accent? You know, he was able to step into that role relatively easy and not have all of these, you know, other roles shadowing it.
Right, precisely. Tennant, for that matter, was far more recognizable for his stage work than anything that he had really done for extended screen work prior to his casting. He was probably, if anything, one of the most recognizable names that could have stepped into the role at the time. And then Matt Smith was an absolute unknown.
Yeah.
I mean, so I would think it may be a little more difficult if you were to say, oh, you know, we're looking over the age of 50 or so, or we've got individuals on we've got individuals on our list right now that range anywhere from their, you know, their mid 20s to over 50. I don't think you're going to be seeing, any of your major cast of MI5 or something like that, or you know, names that while they may still have some obscurity here in the States, you know, a Brit viewer is going to look at it and say, oh, that was that bloke who was in, you know, this series, this series, this series, this series. I don't think the list is going to be that long.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that came up a little while ago is that there was a little bit of an uproar on the internet, you know, like there usually is.
No.
I mean, there's all this discussion about race and gender and all this different stuff and all these different aspects of the Doctor, and people were starting to get upset that, you know, now that Americans make up a very, very large portion of the fan base, why aren't we considering an American Doctor? And I've got to say that I don't like the idea of an American Doctor.
If you want to know what the potential influence of an American Doctor would have on the show, watch Torchwood Miracle Day.
Yeah, that's a good example. Or if you can get a hold of them, they're hard to find. The scripts for the aborted American series that was supposed to come after the Paul McGann movie.
Right. Yeah.
It makes you
even off the page. You know, right off the page, you can tell that there's something inherently wrong with what. And I'm not talking like an expat or anything like that. The show itself has a feel, has a pace, has an identity, has a soul to it that's just inherently Britain.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just it may be intangible. It may not be something that I can very easily quantify. I'd probably have to sit down and write a bit of a dissertation on it to really kind of take it apart. But we see this time and time again with a number of, especially things like dramatic series or comedy series that start out doing very well, or even, God, even reality television shows and all those things. So many shows that end up getting brought over to the States and either repurposed, reinvented, or they actually take them line for line and attempt to perform them in a U.S. tone,
yeah,
and it's a complete failure. Or they have to completely change the show in order to make it work as a U.S. show, and then it's really not the same intellectual property.
Exactly.
I'm thinking of Being Human.
Yeah.
You take that series in the U.K. edition, and while it followed kind of similarly for a little while, you tell very quickly that the U.S. version couldn't work using the same pace and storyline and character interaction and situations because it just wasn't it wasn't something that would even play on the U.S. scope.
Yeah, and they drastically had to change the two shows kind of did follow the same path for a while, and now they've split completely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean the American version is doing well now that they figured out we've got to go a different path. But you know, going back to the topic of an American Doctor, it's you can't do that with this show. It's not the American version of Doctor Who. This is Doctor Who. So you've got to stick with what it is and not try and fit it into some box just because there's a reason why our numbers are growing so big in America, and that's because it's working. So don't try and pander to us. Just continue making the great show that we fell in love with.
Absolutely. At the peak of its popularity, I take a U.S. show and turn the tables around. At the peak of its popularity in the late 90s, The X-Files was being broadcast in over 70 languages in 140 countries. But there was never any talk of making a version of it anywhere other than where it was being produced by 1013 Productions. Granted, they were shooting in Vancouver, but then again, everything over here is shot in Vancouver.
Exactly.
So whatever.
Get all
but
the
it was
best
still
actors
US
from
show.
There. You know, it's
yeah. But that's, you know, it's just, it's part of the soul of the show. And I don't see it functioning. Spinoff or something? Yeah, whatever, if you want to try it. But you screwed the pooch on Torchwood.
Yeah.
You know, you took something that while you did have, an American speaking actor, I know Barrowman's Scottish, but you take, an American character, and still keep him within that Welsh backdrop, and it still works brilliantly.
Yeah.
Bring him over to the United States, start having him run around with far too many guns and too many chase sequences and dramatic music that's a little bit over the top, and all of a sudden you're watching something that just isn't Torchwood anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So don't hold your breath for an American Doctor. Maybe they'll hope baby steps. Go with maybe we'll get another an actual American companion, not a Briton doing a U.S. accent,
and a horrible one at that too.
Sorry, Perry.
No. But one thing you can expect, apparently, according to Mr. Moffat, is Vastra, Ginny, and Strax returning.
Yeah.
He said that they're all enormously popular characters, and we've got Clara still continuing. That allows us to do the regeneration in a very different way from the way that we did it in the 11th Hour.
Yep. Because now you've got a common thread. You've got characters that can see him through.
Yeah.
Which is so reminiscent of the other regenerations that we've seen where there'd be Sarah Jane staying over him or what have you, to be able to kind of to see this, or Mel or whoever it was to see the change occur and help explain to the audience as well as the other characters in the scene that he's going through a rough time.
Right.
Or he's going to be a little loopy for a little while.
Yeah, but I've got to say, I mean, it would almost be stupid at this point because, Vastra, Ginny, and Strax have become fantastically, brilliant characters in their own right and very, very recognizable now, especially Dan Starkey as Strax. I mean, he's got all kinds of different things that he's doing on the side that people just fall in love with, like the Ask Strax stuff that he does.
And the field reports and so forth, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it would just be stupid to cut them loose at this point. That's almost like finding out that River is actually Amy and Rory's daughter, spoilers, and then never seeing her again. Yeah, you've got to stick with them.
Well, that's an interesting point because Moffat's also discussed River specifically. I'll throw in my two cents here about the Paternoster gang. There's been a lot of jabber, lately about people demanding a spinoff for the three. Has a lot of viability to it. It could be, could be tremendously successful if it was given enough of a budget to see it out more than, a 4-episode, 5-episode little mini series or something, if they want to test the waters. But the production schedule as it demands right now is psychotically paced.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to see this come about unless Moffat steps down as showrunner or unless he gives it to somebody else to do, because he can't possibly do both of them.
Yeah. And I don't really think at this point he has a second in command that he could hand the reins to for something like this, that which is still sort of considered under the scope of his property, that he doesn't inherently need right now for the programs that he's got in production. He has his right hands, right? Yeah, multiple right hands. He's like Ganesh. He's got lots of hands. Yeah. He's got his right hands, but they're needed.
Yeah.
It's not like he's been keeping a farm team off to the side.
It would definitely be a disservice to both shows if he tried to do that, or to do it himself, or give it to somebody that is definitely needed on Doctor Who. So, is it a possibility in the future? Yeah, but it's not going to be the immediate future. No.
Right. Yeah. So, but I absolutely agree with people that feel that they are a great addition to the extended companion set. The idea of having this group that while we would normally consider them to be sort of locked into that particular 1800, Victorian Yorkshire, but we get them out of that backdrop every once in a while, and they still continue to be tremendously rewarding from an intellectual standpoint. The great interplay between Jenny and Vostra as just these two great power female characters. Strax as his comedic relief, I understand, that's great. But he'll get his day in the sun. He'll get a chance to raise the battle cry again, I'm sure.
Oh yeah.
But you did mention, also the idea of not knowing about the return of someone like River. He has made some statements to this extent as well, in an interview with IO9. He said that he's not absolutely sure yet whether or not he considers River's chapter to be closed. He kind of agreed that it would have to be something that would be inherently beneficial to the story first, because he's given in his opinion, a quite acceptable conclusion, or I should say a farewell to her in the name of the Doctor, with him saying goodbye.
Yes.
So if he wanted to, if the perfect opportunity didn't come around, he would leave it out, and we would be none the wiser, and I don't think that we'd be given any detriment for that. But I mean, if he thought there was a place that he could just have her kind of breeze through, then, and he really thinks he could pull it off, yeah, I'd be interested to see it.
Yeah, it would be very difficult, at least in my opinion, because it was such a good way to say goodbye to River Song that if he brought her back and didn't do it right, it would very much be similar to bringing Rose back and giving her a doctor. Mm. Yeah. It's, if you're going to bring her back at this point, you have got to make it stick. You have got to make it powerful. And I personally don't see a way of doing that without undermining the great farewell that we got in the name of the Doctor.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, he's made statements about the fact that his goal with a lot of the writing, the actual composition of the episodes themselves, and just the overall approach to the show, is one where it has to be firing full tilt all the time, because the expectation levels have been ratcheted up to such an extent that whichever emotional bent you're going for has to be turned to 11. You know, he had said things like, you know, every episode has to be, as his quote was, every episode has to be fast and funny, emotional and inventive. Every scene has to end in a cliffhanger. Every moment has to be huge and powerful, and that's the aim. You know, whether we do it or successfully pull it off every time is another matter, but that they have set the bar for themselves that high. So if you're just trying to placate the fans or the most vocal of the butthurt fans and throw a character in where it isn't warranted or give a revival to a character that people have been clamoring to see again, but it doesn't serve that paradigm of making the show just the spectacular that we've come to expect from it all the time, don't do it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and then something else that Moffat has said is that the Doctor could be very different. He said you can push that new Doctor a bit further, maybe if you've got a familiar world around him. This kind of excites me. It depends on what he means by doing something different or pushing it further. Mm-hmm. You know, are we going to see a possibly alien-ish looking Doctor? Are we going to see, you know, a Doctor who is more willing to resort to violence or far less willing to resort to violence? You know, the possibilities are exciting. Mm-hmm. They're also slightly terrifying.
Yeah.
Or is he going to stick with what works and just tease us with statements like this?
Right. I think in because he kept that rather carefully phrased.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of pushing a character further can be done in a lot of different ways. It can be giving the character situations or scenarios that that they are not particularly or have not been traditionally equipped to handle. So maybe that means family. You know, the Doctor, we don't really get this whole aspect of family every once in a while. He's got a backstory, you know, that we never really get much of. He could have a field day for multiple episodes going back. And just, if he just decided to say, you ever wonder about that whole granddaughter thing?
Oh, yeah.
And just leave it at that? Boom! You know, there goes the whole interwebs.
Oh, yeah.
So, and that would be something rather uncomfortable. That's pushing the Doctor. Because the last time we dealt with something like that, it was just accepted. No, I'm the Doctor, I'm William Martinell, this is my granddaughter, and we're off to have a couple of adventures. I'm a grumpy old man. And it just was.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if they were to reintroduce that, it would force the character, as we now know him, her, it, them, to address that in some regard, or explain it, or justify it to the audience. Mm-hmm. I would consider that to be a push further for the character.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean that would be an exciting change too. That would be something that would really get the attention of a lot of people, you know, classic and new Whovians alike. Mm-hmm.
So the push further could be in terms of having to, you know, we've dealt with the Doctor's take on mutually assured destruction and genocide and a lot of these sort of large-scale confrontational issues as seen from the perspective of someone who is typically pacifist in nature. So maybe the push farther is what happens when he is given, similarly to when he was brought on as scientific advisor for UNIT for so long, that they actually talked him into having to be some form of a government body or some sort of governing structure that they asked for his contribution on. So now it becomes something where, similarly to what we've seen with some other shows lately, it typically used to be sort of monsters and paranormal and all things like this, and all of a sudden they throw this political bent into it. You know, I'm thinking of something, granted, and it's, I don't watch it, I don't care a damn about it, but True Blood being all, you know, vampires and werewolves and were hamsters and were geckos and whatever it is that they have running around. All of a sudden, from what I understand, some of the things that kind of, you know, very divisive among the fan base is they started talking about the idea of having this political structure among the vampires. They devoted almost half the energy of the season to, maybe last season was. And some people really hated it because they wanted to see naked vampires rolling around in the dirt. And other people said, oh, cool, all right, this is actually kind of intellectually challenging because they're talking about this political structure among them in these plays for power as far as governed force. Well, what about if the doctor was brought on to assist the UN or something of that sort? Because of the fact that he is inherently recognized, at least on Earth, as this keeper of the peace. He may be recognized as the coming storm off planet.
Right.
But you know, as far as we recognize him. So
yeah, it would definitely be interesting seeing what Moffat has in mind to push the Doctor. You know, there's all kinds of stuff. Like I said, it's very exciting. It's also very, very terrifying. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens with that one.
Yeah, but,
and then, of course, Stephen Moffat has said that Series 8 is well underway. So the scripts are coming in. We know what we're going to do and how it's going to end and what it's building to. And this terrifies me. I'm hoping that he's lying through his teeth on this.
I call outright shenanigans.
Because he's not even, you know, as of Comic-Con, he said he was about 20 pages into the Christmas special. So yeah. It's like, and yeah, you've got other people that might be writing scripts for Series 8. That's fine. But you're far and away from, you know, doing anything special with it. And if he does have people writing scripts at this point and he's already got that all in the works, I'm scared because I want him to have a stronger hand on Series 8 than he did on Series 7, because that was all over the place and it really could have used a stronger guiding force. And if he's not supervising what's going on with Series 8 while he's writing the Christmas special, bad stuff can happen.
Well, this is kind of my hopes, and maybe this eventually I can find some interviews or articles that allow me to sort of flesh out this process. But take an encapsulated episode writer, whether it be guy, I don't know, it doesn't matter. I'm curious to know if some of the process for putting together a new episode doesn't involve working pretty much from a blank slate. And saying, you know what, I'd like to take an episode that's going to be taking place in this time and location. I'd like to involve these characters that we haven't seen in a little while, or I'm going to introduce some characters that are going to be slowly killed off through the episode. You'll never hear from them again. And then they hand this sort of a rough cut to Steve-O and company, and Steve-O keeps a short stack of these things, and then says, okay, mates, I've been talking with my creative team, and we're working on a skeletal structure for how we'd like the flow of the series to go. We need to hit these key milestones along the way. You know, this is sort of the loose path, and your episodes need to find some way to be able to at least get us a little bit closer from point A to B and B to C and so forth. So he takes those scripts that are very encapsulated and says, okay, and maybe with a little advisement, hands them back to the writer and says, all right, now use this as your A story, and your B story, get my characters from here to here.
Yeah. And that's, I think Series 7 could have greatly improved from that. You know, had he done that a bit more with Series 7, I think it could have been a fantastic series. But
yeah.
As it was, we got, you know, we got things like The Rings of Acton and The Crimson Horror and A Town Called Mercy.
Right. Yeah.
So
that's, I think now more than ever, the strength of that magnification on the microscope for Series 8 is going to be exponentially higher than it was for 7.
Oh, yeah.
Just saying a lot, because 7 was under a lot of scrutiny and we saw the backlash.
Oh, yeah, we did.
You know, we were really impressed. People said nasty things about 6 when it aired.
Yeah. And there are still people that, you know, they sit on one side of the fence or the other. There's people that go back and they're like, oh, I rewatched Series 6. It's still crap. Yeah. And I think part of that is what kind of story you like, because 6 was definitely the overarching story. You know, the series long one story continuously thread through. 7 was little encapsulated episodes that had nothing to do with the rest of them. And a lot of the complaints that you're going to get are because of one storytelling or the other. But then you have people that are breaking it out and being like, no, I'm looking at each individual episode in and of itself, and this was crap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's fair game. Fair game. I'm interested to see, because of the fact that, you know, as you mentioned, he still was saying that he was in the process of completing the Christmas special. He's been grilled to know, not just as much for the 50th, but he's now starting to get poked on this one, because Jenna Coleman had come out at one point and said, you know, between the 50th anniversary episode and the Christmas special, from what I understand of what they're going to contain, it's going to change the direction of the show. Her words.
Yeah.
That's, again, you know, we talk about the fact that she may just be prone to gaffes and things of that sort, or maybe just doesn't kind of choose her words particularly carefully, but that's highly inflammatory.
Yeah, you know? But at the same time, we've gotten that same style of statement from other people as well, saying that, you know, the 50th anniversary is going to change the show forever, and, you know, the 50th anniversary is going to change everything about it. And I think it's just her saying the same statement, but not carefully crafting which words she uses like the rest of the people do. Mm-hmm. She's like, I want to say this, but I don't want to say it exactly the same way, so I'm going to change it and make it sound like it's coming from me. Well, the problem is, if it's coming from you, we expect, you know, some validity to it.
Right. Some of the... And the lies go on and on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
In terms of what he's saying is going to be out there. There have been some suppositions or direct addresses to him about whether or not we were going to get some closure, and that's a specific word that keeps getting bandied about, closure on some of the things that have just been hanging over us for multiple years now.
Why did the TARDIS blow up? Damn it!
Yeah. Why did the TARDIS blow up? What was the whole deal with the Headless Monks, and why they had such an issue with the Doctor, when we never saw them specifically being affronted the way, you know, some of our other classic baddies wanted to gang up on them? They weren't there, you know, at the Pandorica, you know, or Stonehenge. They were not among them. So they were kind of new to this appearance with Madame Kavarian. So there's that question. There's the fact that, are we done seeing the Silence?
Yeah.
Have they been obliterated? Are they still around? Or do we know that they're still around? Are we just not remembering that they're still around, or what have you?
They've been in every episode since.
Exactly. We're just not really paying attention. And he came out and said that he was going to actually address, and in his words, do it all and end it all at Christmas and give closure to some of these questions. That...
I call crap on this one.
You only got 46 minutes.
Yeah. There's way too much to wrap up. And honestly, it seems like the vast majority of the time, he can't remember half the plot holes that he's left. Yeah. You know, how are you going to close up something that you don't even remember? Well, I mean, granted, we remind him of it all the time. But still, if you're not on Twitter, we can't remind you. Come back to Twitter, Moffat.
Never going to happen. That
poor yeah, no. Yeah, he's done. But... still fun to poke at him.
Yeah. So, I mean, he still has a lot of things that he's trying to determine that he wants to include. But the fact that, since we know that one of the anchors of that episode is going to be the fact that we need to see Smith out, that's what everyone's going to be paying attention to.
Yeah.
So if you're bringing up points about the, you know, the Headless Monks, or you're, you know, bringing back the you know, the fat blue man to start spouting some more poetry or what have you, you know, we know also you know, some recent things that have been coming out that the whole idea of what we thought was, you know, on the fields of Trenzalore at the fall of the 11th, well, the regeneration is going to be taking place at Trenzalore,
supposedly.
That I was taking that on some better authority, but Maybe we'll add that to the link dump so people can chew on it for themselves. But I would think that that would make more sense, because I always thought that the little whole idea of him falling,
the fall of the 11th,
was a bit cheesy.
Yeah.
Or an easy out for something that they had spent a lot of time building.
Yeah.
And to just call that a play on words was a bit poopy.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, I don't think there's any way that he can provide near the level of closure that we want, but yeah, or even half that much. I'd be surprised if he's able to close out, you know, even like two of the major plot holes he's left, much less all of them.
Right.
So.
Well, so wrapping here, I mean, we know that he does mislead us. He does throw a lot of unnecessary curves in. He likes to keep us guessing. And I think you and I are in agreement that that's part of what makes the show enjoyable, is because of the fact that it gives us something that we can argue and ponder and gripe about and create betting pools and who knows what else. Because we want to believe that some of the things that he says have a grain of truth to them.
Mm-hmm.
But it keeps us so focused, because now we want to see, just as much as we want to get the actual answers to our questions, we also just as much want to see whether or not he was lying to us. It's half the fun of it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, catching him in a lie is one of the greatest things about the show, is just sitting there like, oh, no, wait, oh, okay, I can see how he got away with saying that. It's,
mm-hmm.
you know, it, I mean, he's very skilled at playing us like that. He knows what he's doing when he says the vast majority of what he says, if not all of it. You know, it's all carefully constructed. He knows if I say this, they're going to react this way, and it's going to be great when they realize I meant this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. He is a writer at heart.
Oh, yeah.
He is a wordsmith. So when he speaks, he's playing with the language, and you've got to be prepared to play the game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just look at the Bells of St. John. I mean, that's a great example of it. Is it, you know, for months, nobody had any clue. They're like, oh, man, it's, you know, we weren't really speculating about it, but it was one of those things that was always nagging at the back of your head. Like, what does that mean? Why did he call it that?
Funeral bells? Could it be wedding bells? Could it be?
Yeah. No, it's just the little sticker on the TARDIS.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Oh, I don't know. But, I mean, that's, no matter what he lies to us about, he makes it a fun ride, and so it's enjoyable no matter what.
So you can always be prepared to tune in to a little mini segment, whether we call it out or not, that is the Steemo Lie Report from week to week, where we will hold up the validity or complete falsehood of anything that spills out of the Welshman's mouth.
Definitely so.
So.
Well, thankfully, now that Comic-Con is actually over, you know, we didn't get any real news during, but now it's actually starting to come out pretty regularly. The big news actually being that the 50th anniversary special is going to be simulcast globally, meaning that it's going to air at the exact same time all around the world. So here in the States, we get to watch it in the early afternoon. You know, Australia is going to have to wake up at, like, you know, 5-6 o'clock in the morning on Saturday or on Sunday to watch it.
I think they'll be willing.
Oh yeah, definitely. So, yeah, and they're doing this in an effort to try and curtail the spoilers.
Yeah, which I think is just a natural progression of things.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think it's brilliant. You know, this is what we need, and I'm sure there's no specifics on what time or how this is going to work with different networks or anything like that. You know, because if you think about it, if you're watching it on BBC America, well, by the time the episode's ends, we're already going to be like 10-15 minutes behind because we've got commercials. So unless they skip the commercials for that, make it a special sponsored thing or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it depends on how they
work. Which would be totally applicable in this case.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now it becomes one of those things where, you know, BMW or Mini sponsored the next uninterrupted hour. They've done that for far lesser television engagements than this.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that, I don't know, this is going to be interesting. And then, you know, you're probably going to have the, you know, broadcast at this time, and then we'll do it at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock for the regular people who aren't, you know, clambering to get everything that they can, you know, especially in Australia. I know that they're gonna be like, okay, we're airing it at this time, and then for everyone who doesn't want to wake up at the butt crack of dawn, you can watch it at this time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we don't know anything about how it's going to play out yet. We just know that we're going to be getting it early. Yay!
So, but in kind of going along with it, you're talking about coming out of the con season and things, and the fact that we should start expecting some new. Now, there was quite a kerfuffle.
Oh, yeah.
I dare say a hubbub about the fact that San Diego got a trailer. Or also mentioning spoiler, the ability to keep them contained. A trailer that the UK had not even had an opportunity to see.
Oh, yeah. And the internet blew up. You know, oh, how dare the US get the show before us, and how dare they find all this stuff. It was 7,000 people in San Diego. It wasn't the US. Yeah, and the BBC has come out, you know, making a statement about this, or a snippet. I don't even know if it's a statement. Yeah, just basically saying this was a special thing specifically for Comic-Con. UK fans will get all kinds of special content. Don't worry, we haven't forgot about you. So it's basically like, everybody shut the hell up. You're going to get stuff.
Yeah. I don't know where I sit in the whole thing. I mean, I can understand a lot of their grievances to a certain degree. Maybe that was something that should have been done similarly to this sort of the simulcast. But because of the fact that that small contained group and the gag orders that they've put on them to try and keep them from divulging anything other than the couple of approved still frame shots that they've exposed has been impressive. You know, the lockdown, I'm definitely impressed with it.
Yeah.
Whether they should have done something similarly in some sort of an event in the UK, maybe. Or maybe they're going to extend the olive branch and something similarly to something that they've got coming up before they just throw it on the BBC player and just let the world have it. I don't know. But it's, you know what? At the end of it all, it's business, folks.
Oh, yeah.
It's a business.
Yeah, and so it's going to get released. It's, you know, there's no way that you can keep this under wraps forever. Yeah, it's just a matter of time. They're going to release it when they, you know, when they feel like, okay, it's been enough time. We've given them enough stuff. Let's go ahead and throw this other trailer out there. And they probably won't even tell anyone that it's the one from Comic-Con. They're just going to put it out, and you're going to have those people from San Diego going like, oh, hey, they finally released that. Okay. And the rest of us are just going to be like, yay, new content.
I'll take what you give me when you give it to me, and I will be appreciative of what I'm given. Thanks.
No, I'm going to be clamoring for more and complaining that I don't get it. But yeah, I'll appreciate everything I get. It's just not going to be enough. It's never going to be enough. Never.
Mm-hmm.
But and then also we've got some, as you mentioned before, there's a new front runner coming out for the candidate for the 12th Doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so touching on the older Doctor, we have Peter Capaldi.
Yep,
I'm guessing.
Peter Capaldi. Yep.
Okay. He is the new frontrunner for the 12th Doctor.
According to the odds.
Yeah.
The now umpteenth time revived odds and revised. If you had an opportunity to see, obviously, I mean, he's got a little bit of Whovian cred to him as Caecilius in the Pompeii episode. He was also in Torchwood in the Children of Earth season as John Frobisher.
Yep.
So you might recognize him from that. In terms of just sort of outside of the of that scope, if you wanted to try and say, you know, guys, have there been any movies or anything that I've seen him in that I recognize? I'm trying to go through and think. I'm looking through his IMDb dossier and trying to see some of the things that... well, Dangerous Liaisons. for those of you who kind of go for those sort of dramatic films, if you did get a chance to see Rowan Atkinson's Bean, Mr. Bean movie, you got him in there.
Yes.
That's a great appearance. Boy, that's a claim to fame.
I knew he looked familiar. I was trying to figure. Yeah, definitely.
That must have been it.
Yeah.
But no, it's that idea of, we were talking about the having the profile of a character who's done some work. You know, they've been appearances in some shows that have had some successes, but they've been sort of limited in their scope, so that their chops have been well established, but they're not going to be such a household name that people are going to say, "Oh, I can't accept him or her as a doctor because I'm always going to see them as so and so."
Yeah,
you know, how difficult, how awful would it be to try and break out of typecasting in order to convince the audience that you're the doctor, as opposed to the other way around? You know, coming off the role of the doctor and then trying to establish your career from there.
Yeah. I don't know. The only problem I have is the fact that he's already been in Doctor Who, and it wasn't as an alien. Like, say Dan Starkey were to come and, you know, and try and play the doctor, you know, yes, you'd have to lower the TARDIS console significantly, but it could happen, because, you know, you don't see Dan Starkey, you see Strax, you see all the makeup and everything. But this is someone who, you know, was a human, looked exactly the same, so it would be hard to go back. You know, it's the same thing as seeing Martha in Doomsday, you know, was it Doomsday? I think, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, hey, that's Martha, but it's not, she died, it can't be Martha. What the heck, you know? So,
well, it's, I don't know, but I do like the idea of that type of candidate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, it breaks away from the pretty boy, gives you a character that has done a lot of dramatic work, is not a comedic or clown actor or anything of that sort, but it's not necessarily known as being the brooder or something like that. And from an outside the UK aspect, is almost entirely unknown, and therefore could really kind of challenge the audience to think about the flexibility of who the Doctor can be over the course of just these last few generations. I'd love to see a real shape-up change. I don't think that we need another, you know, 24 to 28-year-old guy with a big head of hair and a, you know, and a winning smile. You know,
yeah.
Maybe he has to have a particularly British jacked grill and a Roman crown. You don't know. I don't know.
I definitely like the way that it's going. Granted, this guy I have a problem with because he's been in the show before, but I like the older guy. I like the, you know, stepping away from what they've had for so long and going back to, you know, the roots of the Doctor, so to speak. You know, and I don't know. I mean, it all comes down to who the actor, you know, what he does with the role.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's interesting. And if this guy gets cast as the Doctor, then I'm going to have a problem with it for like a day or two. And then I'm going to be like, yeah, no, he's good. I'm good. Yeah. It's just because that's how it usually works out.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, if you want to take the individuals who are currently sort of at the top of the betting pool list, and there's a lot of people that have now been sort of bumped down because the likelihood of them being involved when they're either by their own statement or just the fact that the common sense has won over. And I said, you know what, let's just kind of be realistic here. At the moment, yeah, Peter Capaldi is sort of topping the list, along with Ben Daniels, who has been sort of hovering around there for a little while. But also still kind of holding relatively strong. There's some names you're going to have to look up, because just in terms of familiarity, you're going to look at these names and say, but that's a good thing. It's a good thing that you're not going to recognize some of these. But go ahead and note Dan Stevens in particular. Benedict Cumberbatch is still being kept on the betting list, even though he is down somewhere like the 20-1 odds, kind of, you know, really long shot stuff. But that gives you an idea of the kind of the scope that we're dealing with. Daniel Mays, Damien Mulvey, Ben Whishaw, that gentleman whose name, for the life of me, I'm never going to be able to pronounce it because there's not enough vowels in it,
Chiwetel Ejiofor, yeah.
Sure, whatever.
Most people are going to recognize him, at least in America, as the operative from Serenity.
Right, but I'm never going to pronounce his name.
Yeah,
so we're just going to call him Chewy. Chewy Edgy. There.
Yeah.
Well, I think it would be great. You know, he's established himself as being the ability to run a very serious character, obviously.
Yeah.
But something in his delivery is when he's trying to be dry, sarcastically funny, because of the fact that he's so serious all the time, his humor is actually pretty damn funny.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the list and the Ferris wheel goes around and around and around. So we've got a long ways to go. Rupert Grint is still on there. You know, they're not going to roll them out. And then our long shots, I mean, they are still, I mean, seriously, Bill Bailey, David Beckham, I kid you not, you know, are still on this list. So whatever. Have some fun with it, kids.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, we should be hearing relatively soon, though. I mean, if they stick to the schedule that they set with Matt Smith, then yeah, we should probably be hearing about it relatively soon.
But, I would hope, yeah. Or at least know that, or at least get the word that they're starting to narrow the list.
Yeah.
Right now, they're saying, you know, everything up at this point has been, it's completely up in the air. They've barely even, you know, they've hardly just begun. But eventually, I'd just be satisfied to know that they are really, you know, grinding away at it, and they are doing a number of screen tests and quick reads and so forth, and that they're moving along. Just a status update. I don't need to know about, you know, is it a list of a dozen? Is it a list of five? I don't care. Just move the needle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then the Doctor Who Experience has released a official TARDIS studio tours. I'm actually booking my trip to Cardiff right freaking now. I mean, this is awesome.
Yeah. The idea of being able to work, to walk into something of that scale. You know, think about some of the museum exhibits and installations and things you've seen in the past that have really knocked your socks off. And a lot of the times, the ones that seem to be the real jaw droppers are the ones that allow you to see something at the full scale. You know, say it's the Air and Space Museum in D.C. or something, when you finally get a chance to walk up to the LEM and say, "Wow, okay, all right," it always looks so much smaller on your little tiny, you know, 1960s television set or what have you.
Yeah.
But being able to step into the control room, I'm sorry. And especially because of the fact that they are doing it at such a scale.
Yeah.
So a full 360 walk around. That's freaking awesome.
I know they wouldn't let me, but I would love to be able just to like flip one toggle. Just like, let me touch the one button. Let me spin the one dial. That's all I need.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, So if anyone is, you know, considering going to, you know, Europe for any reason whatsoever, or if you're there, you know, this is a huge deal. And it's only like, I think they said the high end of the tickets are like £20. So, I mean, it's not even all that much, you know, skip going out to dinner one night.
Precisely. So, yeah, 1 hour at the pub.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. But yeah, I mean, we've got a group of us that are planning to go out and do a Scotland and Wales trip, but that's not till 2015. Now I've got to move that up.
Yeah, definitely so, because it doesn't say anything about how long it's going to be going on, at least that I was able to find. But yeah, you know, this is not going to be a long running kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
At least, I mean, it could be, but I don't know. We'll have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, so that's definitely, you know, if you've got the means, I highly suggest pick them up.
Oh, absolutely.
So, anything else we got on our news roster for today?
No, that's about it for this week.
Yeah. So for our brief our brief little extra episode here, I'm telling you, give these guys an inch,
Yeah, seriously. All right. Well, yeah, we will be coming back next week to discuss some of the novels in the extended universe or Hooniverse. So we'll be back next week for that. And until then, you know, send us your feedback. Let us know what you think about this. Let us know your favorite Moffat lie. Also, if you've read any of the books, let us know which books you've read, which ones are your favorite, which ones to steer clear of, because there are a few of those.
Yeah,
but yeah.
Oh, and note, in these cases, we're talking not just the novelizations of the, but we're talking things like the Virgin Publications, New Who Adventures that they had done. There was a whole series of them that was just the Eighth Doctor's adventures, because mm-hmm. they loved to try to fill in some of the gaps there. So they literally called the series the Eighth Doctor's Adventures. There was all the ones the BBC sanctioned just within, obviously, since 2005 with the reset. They've been publishing like crazy for extended material there too. So it runs the gamut. This could be anything going back to, you know, some of those really pulp fiction novels that were kicking around for a while with Third and Fourth Doctor stuff in them. Just whatever you know, whatever strikes your fancy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you can find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio. Find us on Facebook. You can find us on iTunes and leave comments and reviews there. We love getting those. Thank you for everybody who's left those. Head over there and do that. You can send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com or just leave comments on gallifreypublicradio.com. Mm-hmm. Anywhere you can get the conversation going is a good idea.
Yes, yeah. Please do. And it doesn't even have to be related to any of the episodes we've had. If it's just general thoughts, questions that you've got, things that have been nagging at you, continuity issues, anything Whovian that you think could be something you'd like to hear discussed, or just want to pick our brain on something, and we'll talk about it with you right there on that particular forum. We're up for it.
Absolutely. All right, well, this has been episode 47 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, Moffat seems to get, like, really into the political mind lately.
Yeah, that made me sad. And this is Keir saying, next week we'll be taking up the whole Santa Claus thing.
We'll see you guys next week.
We'll see.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. Have something you need to say, something we got wrong, or something you just need to weigh in on? Send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio, on Stitcher Smart Radio under Gallifrey Public Radio. Find us on iTunes, where you can leave us comments and reviews. You can also head over to our homepage at gallifreypublicradio.com, where you can leave comments on each episode and get into discussions on the things that we bring up. You can also keep up to date on all the latest news and what's going on in the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.
Now, I'm not going to say it's hot, but when I left work today, I found two hobbits in my van trying to destroy a ring.
Nice. I can't drive stick shift, Mr. Frodo, but I can drive you.